I'm Nonbat. I'm here to tell you a little bit about my story and about the story of the Israeli occupation, some of it. I'd like to ask you to be patient with me because I'm not used to talking in front of crowds in English, and I haven't used my English in 2 years. It's only recently coming back to me. I would like to begin by telling you a little bit about the period in which I decided to refuse. This was the second year of the current intifada, the current uprising in the occupied territories. It was 2.5 years ago, 3 years ago. And at that period, which was one of the hardest periods of the current intifada or of the occupation at all, the IDF used to put Palestinian cities under curfews for longer periods and a lot more often than in the past. And some of the Palestinian cities were under curfew for over 6 months. And that means, if you try to imagine what it means to be under curfew, it means that your children cannot go out to play in the garden. It means that they cannot go out to school or to kindergarten. You cannot go to work. You cannot go out in the streets and just buy something or meet your friends, go visit your relatives whenever you want. And it also means that your economy is sinking, and it means that you're under a lot of stress. The IDF did allow the Palestinians to leave their houses once in a while, usually once in a week or once in 2 weeks. And the problem was that it forced, it didn't have any specific way of informing the Palestinians when they are allowed to leave their houses and when they're not, which means that in many cases, the Palestinians were breaking curfew without being aware to that. And I would like to begin by reading for you a testimony of Ahmad Turki Ahmad Shoshne, who is a resident of Jenin. He was 37 years old at the time, and he was father to 5 children. Here's his testimony. My daughter, Suad, asked me if we could go through the middle of the market, near the shop of Abu Dhum that had been shelled. We approached the city square, where there was stands selling vegetables. I got out to buy bread and potatoes, and the children stayed in the car. Then I walked to another shop and bought eggs, soft cheese, and sausages. Suddenly, around noon, I heard intense gunfire. People began to scream and run in all directions. I immediately ran to my car, put my children who were next to the car inside, and drove to Abu Bakr Street, where I saw people and cars. Then I drove west about 20 meters when I heard more shots being fired. The kids began to scream. I looked behind me and saw a tank standing at the entrance of Abu Bakr Street, about 120 to 150 meters from us. I saw that my son Ail had been injured and was bleeding. I didn't stop and continued driving to get out of the gunfire range. When I left the market, I stopped to see how Nail was. I picked Suad up to move her away from Nail. When I lifted her, I was shocked to see her lifeless body. I began to scream and drove immediately to Al Ghazi Hospital. The doctors pronounced Suad dead on arrival. Nail had been wounded in the right knee and left midsection. Bullet fragments also struck him in the back near the spine. Shada, my other daughter, was also wounded. Fragments had struck her right knee. My friend, Hassan Ali Abu Zed, who had joined us, had been hit under his shoulder, which led to an injury to his intensities. He was taken to Rambam Hospital, where he underwent a surgery. I was told that his condition was serious. Unfortunately, this is not a unique testimony. This is just one of many cases from that period. And I decided to read for you this specific period just because of the fact that it's taken from the period in which I decided to refuse. The second story that I would like to tell you about is a bit more personal. It happened after I actually decided to refuse, but it's a good example of things that happen in Israel. It's a story about my best friend. His name is Asaf. I know him since he was six, when he moved to Israel from the United States. And we learned in the same class from first grade till the 10th grade. And Asaf, like most of the Israeli youth, went into the army without putting too many thoughts into it. And he was recruited to a combat unit. He served in many operations in the occupied territories. He didn't do anything unique. All of the things that he was involved in were really common. And one day, a little bit more than a year ago, while I was under arrest during my trial, I received a telephone call from his mom. And she said, "Noam, Asaf was severely injured and is going through an operation in Tel HaShomer Hospital." Luckily, I was at the same time in an army base that's also called Tel HaShomer, which is 10 minutes walk from there. I was under arrest there. And because of the unique situation, they allowed me, after several hours, to go there and visit him. I got to the hospital. I saw friends of ours, family members, and soldiers that I didn't know. And I went to his mom. She was crying. She looked like she was crying for several hours. And she told me that she thinks that he's not going to make it. To hear that from your best friend's mom is one of the hardest things that happened to me. Probably the hardest moment of my life. And she told me that he got a bullet in his head, and the bullet penetrated through his left eye and hit his jaw. It went through his throat and ended up in his lungs. He was going through the surgery it started at 4 a.m. and it was continuing. It ended up a little bit after noon, and he was unconscious for almost a week. It was a really hard period for me, and I can tell you now that Asaf's situation is fairly well. He lost one eye, but his right eye was not harmed, and his left hand, that was also wounded from a different bullet, is functioning pretty well. And almost got back to normal. And during this period, when Asaf was in the hospital, many of our mutual friends came to me and asked me if Asaf was not holding any resentment towards me because of the fact that he's a soldier wounded in combat in the occupied territories. And I am a refuser. I refused to go to the army. I refused to serve in the territories. And I didn't know what to tell all those friends. I didn't know what to answer because I was afraid to ask Asaf. But after a while, he started talking to me about this issue. And the first time he was talking to me about it was when he told me what happened after he was hurt. He was hit. The operation itself was in a building that was a seven-story building, and it was the house of 27 families. And they were looking for someone who was hiding in that building. All of the families were evacuated before the operation started. And this person was hiding in an elevator. They opened the door. He shot them, they shot him, another soldier. He died, and a different soldier, and another soldier also died. And after they killed him, and Asaf was already in a helicopter on his way to the hospital. They bombed the building. They destroyed the house of 27 families. When Asaf told me that, he found out about it several days earlier or something like that, and he was angry. He was angry because it was not necessary to destroy this house. He said, those families are not responsible and they're not to be blamed for the fact that the terrorist was hiding in their building. And he was angry. And then we started talking about the whole issue of refusal. And what I found out, that Asaf, my friend, that was supporting me mainly as a friend, became now a supporter ideologically and came closer to my opinions. What I learned from Asaf, what I learned from this case, was that people who are hurt, people who lose their loved ones, people who paid price for this bloodshedding conflict, don't have to go and seek for revenge. If you give them proper guidance, if there's someone there for them, they can go out and seek for solutions in order to prevent similar situations from happening to other people. This was the case of Asaf. And later on, I found out that this was also the case of many families that established and were part of the Bereaved Families for Peace Forum, which is a forum that that works both Israelis and Palestinians. When I learned about this forum, I was really happy to find out. It kind of gave me a lot of hope to know that there is such a group. I don't know how much do you know about this conflict, so I'll tell you a little bit about it. Israel opened the war in 1967 in three fronts. Again, the first front is the front against Egypt, and then it also opened a front against Jordan and Syria. The war was over in 6 days, and Israel occupied vast territories from all these countries. And in time, we had peace with Egypt and Jordan, and we returned some of the territories, and the territories that were occupied from Egypt and Jordan that remained under our control are considered to be Palestinian territories. These are what's considered the occupied territories. And when we made the peace agreement with Egypt and Jordan, they waived their right to have these territories when it was agreed that we will give these territories to the Palestinians pending a future agreement between Israel and the Palestinian representatives, the PLO. However, this part of the agreement was never kept, and Israel, by that, became a nation that is breaking the international law and is also going against the decisions of the UN and the UN Security Council. And if we observe similar conflicts to this conflict, conflicts that had occupation, had colonialist states, such as the British occupation in India, the French occupation in Algeria, the American war in Vietnam, the American occupation in Afghanistan and Iraq today, the Israeli occupation in Sinai, and the Israeli occupation in Lebanon that ended only 4 years ago, all of these conflicts lead us to the conclusion that there is only one solution to these kind of situations. The occupying country will withdraw out of the occupied territories, and an independent state will be established. And anyone who's familiar with this conflict would tell you that he knows in the general lines what would be the final compromise to this conflict. You have three initiations, the Clinton draft the Ayalon Nuseba initiation called the People's Voice, and the Geneva Accords, and they all offer more or less the same thing. The withdrawal of Israel to the 1967 borders, with minor adjustments of the borders subjected to a formula of a yard for a yard, a division of Jerusalem or transformation of it into a binational capital, some sort of creative compromise regarding holy places both in Israel and the territories, and there will be a compromise regarding the 1948 Palestinian refugees issue. This compromise will include recognition of Israel in its responsibility towards the Palestinian refugees, compensation of them, and probably the returning of some of them into the territories of Israel. So the solution is clear, and it's been clear for several decades now. And if the solution is so clear, then it's a bad joke that it lasts. And 37 years, it's a long time for us to tell a bad joke. So we need to ask ourselves, why is that we're not implementing the simple solution to this conflict? And it is a bloodshedding conflict. The answer to that is that against this simple solution stands a united front. I'm talking about a Palestinian and Israeli united front. On the Palestinian side, I'm talking about those terrorist organizations committing malicious suicide bombings against Israeli civilians and sometimes even against Palestinian civilians. On the Israeli side, I'm talking about the settlers. I'm talking about the present government and past governments who refused to talk to the PLO in their time, who continued and continues to build the settlements, who continue to build the separation wall in such a route that severely damages the Palestinians' lives, and who continues to make life harder on Palestinians. There is also a different front. It's the peace camp, the left, whatever you want to call us. I'm part of this camp. It's also a united front of Israelis and Palestinians. On the Palestinian side, I'm talking about Palestinians who are willing to continue and talk to Israelis, even in those bloodshedding times. I'm talking about Palestinians who are continuing to struggle against the occupation in nonviolent ways, as they did in the past. And I'm talking about those Palestinians who are creating an opposition to the terrorist organizations. On the Israeli side, I'm talking about parties, movements, individuals, groups of activists who continue to protest against our government's policy and continue to work in solidarity with the Palestinians, helping the Palestinians to harvest their olives whenever the army is making it harder on them or the settlers. And I'm talking about, in the last few years especially, the refusal movement, which is a growing movement, which I'm part of. However, it is still unclear whether we will win this battle on the implementation of the final compromise to this conflict. And I gotta tell you that we must end it as soon as possible, because it is a bloodshedding conflict. I'm just gonna try and frame it for you and give you some sort of understanding how bloodshedding this conflict is. So I will tell you some of the numbers regarding the last 4 years. There are many things that you cannot count in numbers, but I'm talking about some of the things that happened in the last 4 years, the damages that were caused because of the occupation. I'm talking about the destruction of 1,031 houses of Palestinian families. I'm also talking about the injuries of 6,700 Israelis and 28,000 Palestinians. I'm talking about the lives of 925 Israelis and 2,936 Palestinians. These numbers are updated for 2 weeks ago. So, when I grew up in Israel, like many others, I was aware to all of these numbers that I told you of, to other numbers that were from all those years of the occupation. I was aware to some of the stories personally. I knew people who got killed, and I knew, and I've heard of people who were injured or witnessed suicide bombings. And when you grow up in Israel, you understand that there is something terribly wrong going on. What you don't understand necessarily is that you are a part of the occupying country. People are ignoring the fact that their country is an occupying nation, that the 1967 borders exist in reality. This is something that you don't see in Israel. It does not exist on maps, and you don't learn about it in school. But at one point of my life, I started understanding that if we have the army trying to fix this situation for so long, and it's just becoming worse and worse, we're doing something terribly wrong. There must be something that we can do differently. Then I started asking myself questions. I then realized that we are the occupying nation, and it is our responsibility to change this situation. This was when I decided to refuse. And I decided to refuse and to take responsibility over the situation because I understood that no one will take responsibility in my behalf. And that if I won't do it, everybody will have the excuse not to do it. So I decided to refuse and to become a conscientious objector. And to be a conscientious objector in Israel is not an easy task. It's not an easy task because you don't get support from the society, but it's more complicated and harder because of the fact that many of the conscientious objectors in Israel are being imprisoned. And up until recently, the army's policy towards induction refusers was to send them to 3 or 4 consequential periods in a disciplinary procedure. Each period varies from 1 week to 1 month, usually more towards 1 month. And this was their policy in the past. But around July 2002, the number of induction refusers was growing. And from 1 or 2 in prison, at any given time, the numbers jumped to 5 and 6. And by December that year, we became 10 refusers imprisoned at the same time. Because at the same week that I entered prison in December, there were 4 other refusers who entered prison with me. And in addition to that, and also because of that, we began to receive more media coverage. And all of that must have frightened the army. And they have decided to change their policy towards us. And after spending 3 consequential periods in prison, I was sent, along with 4 other friends of mine, to a court-martial procedure, during which I was under arrest, during which my friend Asaf was wounded. And that court-martial procedure ended on January 4th, 2004. And we received 1 year imprisonment in addition to all previous periods served. Why was the army so afraid? What was it so afraid of? To my understanding, The army was afraid of the impact that the act of refusal is capable of achieving. What we now know is the act of refusal is capable of putting a mirror to the faces of the Israelis, because we come from within the Israeli society and we're breaking these taboos. So it's forcing on them to listen to what we have to say. And it's saying to them, in fact, this is us. It's putting a mirror to their faces and saying, this is us. We're the Israeli society and we're an occupying nation. And that is horrible, because we harm both the societies, and it's immoral. We must not take part in that. That saying is weakening the people who govern this policy. It's also putting us in solidarity with the Palestinians, because of the fact that they can appreciate the fact that we're willing to sacrifice our freedom in order to prevent harming them. And this was the effect that we tried to achieve. Because when we decided to refuse, when I decided to refuse, and when other people decided to refuse, we wanted to reach the Israeli society. We wanted to approach both the societies and to inspire people to protest against the occupation. We wanted to inspire Palestinians to act in non-violent ways against the occupation. And we also wanted to reach other people from other countries, especially people from the United States, because of the United States' responsibility in its policy in the Middle East towards what's going on there, towards this occupation, in the fact that it backs up Sharon's government on everything that it does. And this is why I'm here. This is why you can say whatever you want in a few minutes and ask questions if you have any. I'd be glad to answer all of them if I can. But first, Rupa will say a few words. Yeah. Thank you.
We're going to be taking questions in a minute. And what I want to do is really thank the sponsoring organizations for making this possible, because this is a national tour. And this tour is sponsored by the Refuser Solidarity Network and the American Friends Service Committee.
Yes.
How were you treated in prison, and how did your family deal with this?
In prison, it really depends in what prison, because I have been to quite a few. First of all, I was to begin with, I was in a military prison called Prison Number 4. And the treatment over there was really terrible, but it wasn't something that was pointed at me or at the refusers. It's just the way that the army wants to break people and he wants to make their life miserable when they're imprisoned, because it's kind of part of their policy to have people suffering. And after the trial was over, we spent a month and a half in the army's prison number 6, and from there we were transferred to a civilian prison, and there the treatment is a lot better, because of the fact that their interest is to make sure that there aren't riots inside prison. The best way to make sure that that happens is to give people a fair treatment. Regarding my family, at the beginning it was pretty hard for them. It was also very hard for other refusers, and there were quite a few, as I mentioned it. So they established a parents' forum that really began as a support group, and later on arranged money to get our legal aid and did a lot of stuff. It was really helpful for them because they were able to do something. They keep saying that they don't think that they've managed to reduce one day of our sentence, but at least they were helping us publish what we were trying to say and get to the public. In that sense, it really helped them and us. Yes? There isn't really a requirement. Everybody who lives in Israel, you don't have to be a civilian, is supposed to be drafted. But if you're an Arab civilian, then you're not drafted. And except for that, everybody's supposed to be drafted. But then you have all sorts of reasons why people are not drafted or get exempt. Some of them are fake. People who want to avoid the military can either declare themselves religious and say that they're studying religion, which is one reason to be exempt in Israel. And one of the most common ways to get out of the military is to say that you are incompatible because of mental issues or family issues and personal issues. So it's really easy to be exempt, but everybody's supposed to be drafted, theoretically.
Of the solutions, you know, that you propose, the one that I would guess would be the most difficult for most Israelis would be the one about compensation for displacement, and even more so, you said allowing a certain number of Palestinians to come back into Israel. That's the first part of my question. And the second part, which is related, what would your response be to an Israeli who argued that many hundreds of thousands of Jews were displaced from Arab countries in 1948 and ended up in Israel without being compensated or without having a right to return to their homes, and who would argue that it's not fair for there not to be a balance or reciprocity? What would you respond to that?
To the first question, of course, I agree with you that it is the most problematic issue for Israelis, because we, as a society, have racism issues within us, and it's really a problem for us because of our ethnicism to see Palestinians coming into a state that we established and call it a Jewish state. But it is necessary, and more people understand it. The problem with the compensation is not really a problem, because there were several European countries who, for that cause, were willing to give money. There is already a huge amount of money coming from Europe for good causes, for peace groups in Israel. For instance, the group that I mentioned, the Bereaved Families for Peace, received quite a lot of money from Europe. They were actually able to establish all sorts of incredible ideas. For instance, they had an idea that the Europeans funded. It was a telephone service in which you could call. It was called Hello Shalom, Hello Peace. You could have telephoned there, and it would connect you to a Palestinian who was also contacting. You could speak to someone from the other side. So you could hear that there are people who want peace on the other side. So there is money that you can get for this purpose. The other issue that you asked about what would I say to an Israeli or somebody who supports Israel who claims that it's unfair that there were Jewish people who left Arab countries in 1948. First of all, you need to understand that it's really rare that they were expelled from these countries. Israel was getting as many Jews as possible to make Aliyah to Israel from many Arab countries. There were cases of persecution in those countries, but it was really rare. However, Zionist groups, Zionist historians, try to rewrite the history and said it wasn't like that. And they do it in many ways and for many reasons. One of the reasons is because they want to convince people who are living in offsprings of people who are living in Arabic states that they need to hate people, Arabic people within Israel because they were treated badly in those countries, which is not true. Most of these countries weren't very successful countries, so nobody's situation was pretty well. But on the other hand, the Jews were not treated that well in Europe, as you all know, and were treated a lot better in all of the Arabic countries. So this is what I would tell him, that most of the Jews from all those countries left because they wanted, and Israel organized them to make Aliyah and to come to Israel. Yes.
It looks like Arafat might finally be at his end. Do you think there's any opportunity for a democratic leader to emerge from the Palestinians at this point? Do you see the same status quo of Mahmoud Abbas or somebody who comes from the same group? Is this an opportunity that we're seeing possibly, or?
Well, no, it's not an opportunity because the problem is not Arafat. I mean, Arafat is a problematic person on its own, but I wouldn't say that he's not democratic. In that sense, that besides the fact that he is corrupt and people from within his group are corrupted, the fact that he was not re-elected is not because they didn't want to have elections, but because of the fact that Israel was denying the Palestinians the possibility of elections. They offered to make elections several times, and Israel did not make it possible. You have to understand that Israel has destroyed in the last 4 years all kind of Palestinian authority that was starting to be established during the Oslo agreements. So if Arafat will be dying in the next few days, we're expecting more chaos, and I doubt if Sharon will give them the opportunity to have elections. If he will, then it's a good thing. But he should be doing that even if Arafat will stay alive. That has nothing to do with it. Yes?
Could you speak just a little bit about the differences? I've heard that there are some Israeli soldiers that serve Israel, but they refuse to enter the occupied territories.
Mm-hmm.
And other, I'm sorry, like yourself, you refuse military service entirely?
Yes.
Just give me an idea of sort of the dissatisfaction within the military.
Okay.
Clearly, some soldiers are very happy, you know, serving the government. Okay. But some are willing to just stay.
Yeah. Well, you have to understand that they come from similar understanding to what I am, to what I have. They understand that the occupation is bad, but they think it's more an issue of what is your red line? What do you say, this is what I'm not going to cross? I think that the problem within Israeli society and with every occupying society is that you keep pushing that line. You keep getting it further and further. So I put a line in entering the army in that situation in which we are an occupying nation, and they drew the line within the getting to the territories. So it's just a difference of where does your line start.
How much within the military, 5% of the military is strongly dissatisfied or upset, or 1% or 10%?
I guess that probably 50% are unsatisfied with what's going on in the army. Maybe less. It's really hard to tell, but it doesn't mean that they're refuseniks. Only about 13-14% of the Israeli army is combat soldiers. There are some people who try to avoid becoming a combat soldier in order to not serve the occupation in a way. But I believe that everything you do in the army is serving the occupation, and therefore I decided to refuse. I don't know how many soldiers within the army are actually active refusers, in a sense that they told their commander, if you send me to the territories, I will refuse. But there are many people who try to avoid it. Yes?
I think Israel is still the largest recipient of U.S. military aid, and yet if you asked most of your audiences that you're going to meet with, people don't have any idea. So I was curious if you could enlighten us a little bit about what U.S. tax dollars are doing in Israel.
We have one of the largest air forces in the world, which is something incredible for such a small country. And this is because we buy all these F-16 and F-15 from the United States. I think we have the fourth largest air force in the world. It is something incredible, but I'm not sure, so maybe I'm wrong about the place, like fourth, maybe fifth. So this is where your money goes to.
U.S. corporations.
U.S. corporations are, yeah, they're in Israel in many ways. Like you have Caterpillar. This is not through the U.S. money, but because we use Caterpillars in the settlements and when destroying houses in the territories. This is all American equipment. Yes.
When you were answering my question before, I needed a clarification on something. Did I understand you to imply that you advocate that Israel should no longer be a Jewish state? Because that's an awfully big one to just go by so quickly. I mean, is that the way that you see things?
Yes, I think that Israel should not be a Jewish state, because I think that you shouldn't have any states in the world that are based on religion. It's really, I think that it's something that is one of the only things that is really obvious to American audience, that you should have separation between the religion and the state for various reasons. One of them is because it discriminates whoever is not Jewish, but also because it harms people who are Jewish within Israel. For example, because of the fact that you have a Jewish state, it calls itself Jewish, then you have to ask yourself in what sense it's Jewish. Then it's starting to have Jewish legislation. And I, for instance, cannot have civil marriage in Israel. There is no such thing. And I can't get married with a person who's not Jewish in Israel at all. And because I'm enforced to get married through rabbis, through religious marriage. And this is just one of the examples of what's happening when you get a state that is Jewish. But probably the main reason why I oppose to it is because it discriminates everyone who's not Jewish by definition.
Is that viewpoint typical of refusers, how does that go?
Depends in what group. I guess the group that I'm a part of is the most radical organized group of refusers, and probably because we're young. And yeah, I guess it depends in what group. In other groups, it's not like that. But also in Ometz Lesarev, I know some of you probably have heard of them. It's in translation to English, it's the courage to refuse. Many of them support that stand, but the people who are the most influencing among this group do not support this stand. They're more Zionist, but other people from within this group, I think they're probably the majority, do support it.
You said that there are Palestinians who are working for peace nonviolently.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how are they able to function, in the situation? Do they get a lot of pressure from other Palestinians, for example, as well as from the Israeli government?
I'm not sure about pressure from the Palestinian side, and it's really hard to tell. But they do get a lot of pressure in all sorts of ways from the Israeli government. One of the most obvious ways to see it is that they're being shot at. And if you're going... it started in the first Intifada, that started as really a non-violent uprising. It was mostly demonstrations, but then the army sent soldiers to shoot them They said they were shooting rubber bullets, but what is called in the media rubber bullets are actually regular bullets with rubber coating. So it is less fatal, but it can also be fatal, especially if it's from short range. And this was usually the case. And yeah, there is, so they do get a lot of pressure from Israeli from the Israeli army, and this is one of the reasons, and along with ideological reasons, because of which they usually protest when they're with Israelis together, because it's more complicated for the army to shoot them when we're Israel is also in the crowd. But it's also happening in the last few months. So there were several Israeli protesters. One of them is a friend of mine who were shot in demonstrations. Yes.
Regarding the two-state solution, I myself favor it, and I'm not sure now because I attended a meeting in the Middle East at the American Foreign Service Committee in Boston last year, where I heard Sarah Roy and Hilda Silverman, who are the two activists on the whole issue. They had a map of the West Bank and how it's been crisscrossed by roads, how it's been cut up into sections. And if they do, my feeling is, if it does come to two states, the Palestinians really aren't going to have much there. It's almost like a Bantustan situation.
Well, the West Bank is still the same amount of territory that it was in 1967. The fact that we built roads does not make any difference. In fact, it currently does not help the Palestinians because most of them, or a huge amount of these roads, are just for settlers. But the minute we leave this the West Bank, it kind of helps the Palestinians because they get free roads. They get them from us. So that does not make any difference.
How will the settlers be dealt with if it does come to that? Because, you know, there are a lot of, not all of them, but in fact most of them would go, but there are a lot that are very hardcore religious, and I think they're going to really fight that situation.
That is a difficult question, but we do have an example of Israel evacuating 50,000 settlers in Sinai, which was made pretty easily. They did it in a week or so, and we managed to do it. So now we have more, but we're not talking about millions. We're talking about 370,000 settlers. It's a lot more, but it's still in the same proportions. We're not talking about a huge number of them. And also, I think that with monetary aid, we can persuade most of them to do it on their own.
Could you share a little bit of your personal story? I'm curious about how you have the courage that you do. Does your family support you? You seem like a very unique individual.
People often seek for a specific moment, a specific incident or something like that cause people to refuse or to do something unique. But in fact, it's usually a process that you go through. And for me also, it was a process. I was never a conformist person. I was always a non-conformist. And for instance, I was opposing to several things that were happening in my school and in the Israeli education system. So I left school after the 10th grade. So I educated myself for 2 years to finish my high school education. And then I did 1 year of volunteer service. It's an option that you have in Israel to postpone the army in 1 year in order to do a voluntary service for the community. And I did that. It kind of gave me, in addition to the fact that I was a non-conformist person, it also gave me a year during which most of my friends went to the army, and I was able to hear from them about some of the things that they're doing without stepping in the door of the army, getting inside already. So I had time to think about it, and I had thoughts about it from before. I started thinking about it when I was 15, when I got to to the arm to you get invited to the army before it when you're 16 to for an interview. And then I told them I'm going to be a refuser, but I said I'm going to refuse and be a combat soldier. As you mentioned, there are several kinds of refusers. So I was planning to be that kind of refuser, and I was hoping that they will allow me to avoid being a combat soldier. But when I did that year of civilian service, I've heard all of the things that were happening in the territories, and I didn't want to deny the Palestinians the thing that I was looking for, the children that I was teaching in the boarding school that I was teaching in that year. I also heard from a friend of mine that was a soldier, something that later on came out to the press, that the IDF had at that period a policy of using Palestinians as human shields. And all of these things together gave me the opportunity to refuse. Does that answer your question?
Except for the part about whether you're family or not.
Well, at the beginning they didn't. It was kind of hard for them. My father was an officer in the army for almost 10 years. And my mom, it was hard for her to support me because she was afraid, not ideologically. But in time, and after the parents' forum that I told you about was established, it was easier for them to support and to understand, and they've met other people their age who support me. So they had other people apart from their son saying that you can do, that it's moral and that it's good to be a refuser. And my mom became a really ideologically a supporter, and she's now involved with other struggles, other fronts, against settlements, against checkpoints and things that happen in checkpoints. I want to maybe to explain. People often talk about the checkpoints and you think that they're meant to prevent people from penetrating to Israel and to make terrorist attacks. But in fact, while there are some checkpoints like that, most of the checkpoints are within the territories and they're preventing the Palestinians the right of movement inside the territories. So it's not necessarily about people who are trying to penetrate Israel. So, yes.
Now, when you think about the publicity that you have received in the Israeli media about your message about the occupation, I'm curious to know if you're satisfied with the level of publicity you've gotten around your message and what you're trying to say.
No, not at all. That is, I guess you expected that kind of answer.
What kind of support are you getting?
I will explain. First of all, at the beginning, it was really hard to get media coverage. Whenever they did not talk about the message. We had other ways to try and transfer the message and link it with the media coverage that was on the trial. So we did some publicity on our own. But they tried to avoid the message. One of the most drastic cases in which I remember that they had really been against us and in a really vicious way and stupid also, was when we, the five that were trialed during the time that we were under arrest, we wrote a letter. It was our initiation to write a letter addressed to the Palestinian people and to call them to act in nonviolent ways. We were saying we're refusers, we're being imprisoned because we refuse to serve the Israeli army, and we want you to have your rights, but we want you also to act in nonviolent ways. And it was a call to the Palestinian people. And then we organized 100 other refusers to sign it. Afterwards, there were more. And we tried to go public with it. We managed to get it publicized in the three largest newspapers in the occupied territories, but there was not even one newspaper that published it in Israel. There was one time that they talked about it in the Israeli TV, and they had someone to talk against it, how bad it is. And I couldn't really understand, and up until now I don't have any understanding of what was their argument against it, because all it was a letter calling the Palestinians to work in nonviolent ways and not to support terrorists. But they managed to find someone to talk against it. So it's one example. It's probably a bit of the drastic example, but there were several other examples. Yes.
I'll ask another question, and that is, do you think that the Palestinians might really feel a sense of despair given the power of Sharon, the fact that Israel is the most powerful military state in the Middle East, and it's backed up by the United States, which is the most powerful state in the world?
Mm-hmm. I'm probably not the authority to tell you about it, but of course there is a huge amount of despair within Palestinians, also within the Israeli peace movement. And yeah, we're dealing with problematic issues and with huge forces that we need to protest against. So both the Israelis and the Palestinians feel a huge amount of despair. But I think we're dealing with it pretty well. The only way to deal with it is to protest against it, to feel that you're doing something. For a lot of people, but not for all of them, the despair itself is a motivation for action. You use it because if you're in a situation, in a position that you're so depressed because of all of that, then you have no excuse not to do anything. Yes.
How do the Israelis, by and large, see the Palestinian-Israeli conflict as it relates to what's happening in the rest of the Middle East?
Well,
they see it as relating to what's happening elsewhere in the Middle East, for instance, what's happening in Iraq.
Some people see it as relate. Some people don't. I think that it relates especially through the United States, which is an aggressive force. But Iraq didn't have a lot to do with the Palestinians because it did not have too much money to support them or something like that. I think that other people in Israel don't really think about these issues. They try to avoid thinking hardly about what's going on, except for the fact that they were thinking that it has something to do with Osama bin Laden or something like that, because they're believing some of the conspiracy theories that Bush is imposing on them. Yes?
Are you here purely for educational reasons, or do you have a call to action for U.S. Americans?
First of all, education is call for action. The first stage before you decide to act is first to educate yourself. If you act before you educate yourself, then you probably do it the wrong way. The second call is that after you do it, you start to look for things that you can do, like boycotting products from the settlements, trying to influence your government's policy regarding the Middle East, regarding other issues around the world. There are a bunch of things that the United States is doing throughout the world that you should try to make sure that your government changes. Yeah, definitely to divest money from companies who work in the settlements. Do you want examples of things that you can do? You can go to Israel and the territories in tours. And there are lots of specific things that you can do in the territories, like join groups like the ISM. It's a little bit dangerous once in a while. It is. They had two people died from the ISM, and one lost his jaw. It takes bravery to do these things sometimes, but there are lots of things that you can do. If you go out and search the net, then you have lots of ideas, but you have to educate yourself first. Okay. Then I'd like to say thank you for listening. And again, pursue knowledge and try to educate yourself and do whatever you can. Thank you for hosting me. Good evening.